Welcome to the Incession Film Podcast for April 28th, 2013. This is episode 10, and I'm JD.
Nate Parsons.
And this is Matthew Mason.
And we, on this week's show, we are going to be reviewing Michael Bay's newest film, Pain and Gain. And to talk a little bit more off of Michael Bay, we are going to be going over our top three action comedies that he's pretty known for. And then we're going to go into film number three for our Baz Luhrmann series, and we're going to review his 2001 film, Moulin Rouge. And then we're going to finish off the show with some movies we've seen this week and a couple of news items that that kind of came out over the last week. So before we get into our review for Pain and Gain, how was your guys' week?
It was pretty good. I watched a little more movies than normal, but don't know how... Yeah. It was a give-and-take kind of week. Some good stuff, some bad.
Well, as you can probably tell, I'm sick. I've been sick most of the week, so this podcast should be pretty interesting.
Entertaining, to say the least.
It absolutely should, so you have to forgive Nate. He's been a little bit under the weather, but a lot of respect for him for being here this week, so we appreciate that, Nate. I had a pretty good week myself. It was kind of funny. Went to see Taylor Swift's concert here in Lexington last night, and... continuing on our Baz Luhrmann series, the last two acts of that concert was very Baz Luhrmann-esque, which I thought was very funny and ironic. So it was pretty interesting. But I'm ready to talk about Michael Bay's new movie. It's very interesting, very different for him. What did you guys think of Michael Bay's Pain and Gain?
Well, I'll lead out on this. I got to write the review of this, which was quite an honor for me to kind of get to tear this movie apart. And not necessarily, I mean, in a bad way, but just Pain and Gain gave me a lot to write about. And not that necessarily I walked away liking the movie, but I respect a movie that can create a great opinion, you know, in a viewer. Pain and Gain tells the story of three bodybuilders who seek to live the American dream, and they do it in a completely illegal fashion. But it's a great story, especially because it's based in real life. But the problem with the film, the main problem, is Michael Bay's approach to it, in that he really does try to turn it into an action comedy. At least for me, that's where it kind of fell apart. It has a really great story, but much of the dialogue is forced at best in so many lines. Some of them are actually legitimately funny, but I think that's due more to the performers who carry them off well, who actually can say them well, not credit to the writers. And then as far as the direction goes, to me, the film meanders too much and kind of teeters so much between like actually high tension dramatic stuff and things that are actually really disturbing to things that are supposed to be light and funny. And it feels really bipolar. And just, and if, I don't know if I've talked about it before, but one of the things that's my least favorite thing in film is films that feel bipolar. They just don't have, they don't really have a sense of cohesiveness and things. Or if it's going to do that, I want to know why it's teetering between the two. This film is very much like Fargo. It's actually pretty much like Fargo in Miami, you know.
Yeah, it is pretty similar to that.
But I mean, it's, you know, there's not much for me that I really want to speak highly of it, except one, the performances. I loved Mark Wahlberg because he was absolutely convinced that he was the character of Daniel Lugo, and he plays it perfectly. I love Dwayne Johnson being able to very deftly portray both the comedic and dramatic aspects of the character that he played. I like Anthony Mackie, who I didn't really know who he was before this movie, and he just left an impression on me. And then Rob Corddry was, I love seeing him in a dramatic role because I don't think I'd ever seen him doing that before, because he felt like a guy who's been doing the dramatic circuit for a while and played it well, as opposed to most of the honestly really stupid comedies he's typically cast in. And the last performance that I really did love in there was Tony Shalhoub, and he just he makes an amazing villain. Like, he goes through all this crap, and I still hated him the entire film through. Like, there's no point where you're ever really rooting for him. You're still rooting for Daniel Lugo and the rest of the guys, even though they're the bad guys. You're still rooting for them. So performances really carried it. There were a few that kind of, I thought, detracted, like Rebel Wilson and Ed Harris. But in general, performances is one of the strongest points of it. And then the thing I would love to talk about that y'all just heard as the podcast started was Steve Jablonski's score. I've listened to it now at least 3 or 4 times.
It is really good.
Yeah, since I saw the movie Thursday night, like, I've been listening to it, and it paints a better picture of the film than the film itself does in terms of visually, because to me, the visual aspects of the film were not what I liked. It was actually listening to the music. And it's really dreamy in a lot of ways. It's very much, it's very, like, it almost has, like, a lot of the sounds are like a CSI, almost television movie kind of feel. But it works really well because of the almost 60-minute style that sometimes the film has. And kind of outside of that, like, there's a lot of, like, distant strings and stuff that just are really unsettling, as well as kind of, like, the monotony of actually some of the music that some of it almost kind of harkened to The Shining for me, and I loved that.
And Jablonski is known for that style. I mean, he's done Desperate Housewives for the longest
time. And he can do that really well, and that was my favorite part. Like, as you can see on my review online, it's the one kind of accolade I gave to this entire film. I gave it an A because so far that's, I think, been my soundtrack of the year that I've listened to, and it's one I know I'll continue to keep listening to even though I didn't care for the movie itself.
Well, Nate, what did you think of Pain and Gain?
I agree with pretty much everything you just said, Matthew. I went into this with pretty high expectations, and I came out of it really disappointed. I am a Michael Bay fan. I like all of his movies, but I did not like this one. This is the first one that I have no desire to ever see again. I go into his films expecting them to be fun, entertaining, dumb, and to not take itself too seriously. And I got dumb, and I got not taking itself too seriously, but I did not get fun or entertaining. All the funny bits were seen in the trailers. The film is entirely too long, which is a common problem in Bay's films. And yeah, it just wasn't fun or entertaining, and I think that's why I'm most disappointed with it.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit on the other side of things from you guys. Before I get into what I think of the movie, I mean, the first thing I want to set up is the fact that Michael Bay, in my opinion, I think gets a pretty bad rap for just putting out a bunch of movies that are, you know, kind of dumb and dull and brainless and all these things that people kind of put onto him. So I feel like there's this sort of expectation that when you go to any Michael Bay film, you're already going in with some sort of mindset. And that may be fair to a certain degree, as a lot of his movies tend to go in that direction. That being said, if you go in with that mindset and you watch this movie, you're going to absolutely think what you just heard from Nate and from Matthew. You're going to maybe be a little bit upset and a little bit disappointed because you're looking at it through that lens. You're not looking at it from necessarily its own movie by itself. You're looking at it straight from a Michael Bay perspective. That being said, this is not a typical Michael Bay film. This is not straightforward. It is very different than everything he's ever done. It's basically a flashback with a bunch of other flashbacks in it itself. It's a satire. This whole movie makes fun of these guys. When you look at the story itself, it's just incredibly dumb, and these people think that they can get away with such an atrocious act and such a dumb thing. And they live it out loud. They try to take over. This rich guy's life and live it out loud in terms of living in this guy's house and driving his cars and all this sort of stuff, thinking that they won't get caught. And in the middle of all of that, they do a bunch of other dumb stuff that I can't go into without spoiling the movie. But that being said, this movie is about the story of them making fun of those guys. It's making fun of the story. None of this is taking itself seriously. I know the real life victims of this tragedy, and the real life guy that Tony Shalhoub plays, his character plays, I know he's come out publicly saying that he hasn't liked it a whole lot, and he doesn't like that it takes this comedic tone. Well, if you look at it from what it's going to be, Michael Bay isn't taking the approach of this is what happened, and you know it was just a you know this kind of a joke. I don't think that was Michael Bay's thought on this at all. I think he understands that it was a tragic thing. People were actually hurt. People were actually killed. I don't think he's necessarily he's not taking the seriousness of that away. I think what he's doing with this film is he is absolutely making a joke out of the guys that pulled this off, and it's a complete satire on them. It's just the way that he approaches this film is very different than Michael Bay, and I give a whole lot of kudos to him for trying to be something that is very different than the stereotype that he is supposed to be, and I think he pulls it off pretty well. While this isn't my favorite Michael Bay film I've ever seen, and I don't necessarily have huge amounts of wants to go see it over and over again like you, Nate. I'm not going to buy it on DVD and watch it a bunch of times like I have for Transformers or some of his other films. But that being said, I liked it. I absolutely respect what he was trying to do with this, and I loved how he shot it. It was very different than what he normally does.
I was going to say, you talked a lot about the real Viktor Kurchov, which was not, you know, his actual name, but his reaction to the film. Do you feel like, and this is for both of you guys, and I'll expand on it before I kind of turn it over to you guys, but was it irreverent, you know? Because that's kind of one of the things that I think unsettled me about the film a little bit.
Yeah, but the story's not about him.
The thing is, because that's the thing with Fargo. Like, Fargo sold, like the Coen brothers sold Fargo as based on a true story and stuff, and it's not actually. It's all made up. It's all fictional. And things, and there was actually a great plot device, and I'll go on record saying I don't like Fargo, so you guys can all take my criticism as I say it. I just don't like it, and it's not for necessarily any approach that it is. It's just it's not my movie. It's not necessarily my sense of humor, but I do respect the way they did it, of saying this is a true story, kind of like doing the exit through the gift shop way, or what Michael Crichton did in his book Eaters of the Dead back in the 70s. You know, of saying, hey, this is a real thing, and then actually by the end you find out that it's not. Feels like Michael Bay has taken a completely different approach in saying, okay, actually this is an actual true story, and this is some really crappy things that have happened here, and still treating it with not honestly much of the gravity that is a real situation. And JD, I very much do understand kind of what you're saying, that yeah, I get that he's trying to make fun of him, and he's a great job of that, actually, of making fun of these guys, because these are guys that I'm honestly okay with making fun of. But part of where it still comes off is I think a lot of the gravity, because there are some you know, like some of the torture sequences do come off as almost comedic. And it's because they are really bad at it, and I get that that's where he's coming from, that angle. But I can see where, you know, like, to me, it does, in some points, almost come off as irreverence. And that's where I'm saying, does he cross a line? That's what I'm asking.
I don't think he does. And personally, because the movie is not about Viktor Kurchov at all, like, he's a victim in this, and I get that. But this movie is not about what happens to him and the tragedy that happens in his life. And I sympathize with that. This movie is about making fun of a ridiculous story and how these guys go about doing it. I mean, there are elements within this movie that when you're watching it, you're like, I cannot believe that actually happened in real life. And in the movie, there is actual words that come onto the screen that says, yes, this is actually still a true story.
Yeah,
to go along with the craziness of the story, that this is not about the victim. And while that's a tragedy, it's about the ridiculousness of what these characters pulled off in real life. And while it might be a little bit exaggerated for film, and some of it is obviously changed to protect the identities of the people in the film, for the most part, though, this movie, that scene, what I just described, is an absolute perfect example of what Michael Bay was doing this. I mean, this movie was set up from the very beginning to be nothing but a huge satire making fun of these guys throughout the whole time. So while I bet if you were to interview Michael Bay, he's not going to sit there and go, well, I don't care what happened to, you know, that character at all, or what happened to the people that are killed, you know, whatever. Like, that's not going to be his heart in this. And I feel like while people may look at it from that perspective, they're looking at it through the Michael Bay eyes that they expect out of this, which is why they come up with that theory to begin with.
Since we saw it on Thursday, JD, you've been kind of making it out like this is something groundbreaking for Michael Bay, and which it's not. I mean, is it different? Sure, but it's still Michael Bay through and through. I mean, the story is Michael Bay. It's crude. It's offensive. It's juvenile, like Michael Bay. I mean, if I didn't know Michael Bay directed this going in, I could have guessed it was him coming out.
I will 1,000% disagree with you. I think from a cinematography point of view, yes, there are some of that which is still Michael Bay. I mean, you have some of the shots with the one explosion, which there was only one in this film, by the way. There was with the explosion with them in the background. Yes, that's very Michael Bay-esque. There was the 360 shot with them in one of the rooms. Yes, that's very Michael Bay-esque. I think outside of that, that is mostly that's it. And yes, there's the Michael Bay humor in it, but this is supposed to be a humorous film because he's making fun of people. So, of course, you're going to have that in it. Kyle Smith, who is a reviewer for the Miami Herald, put it like this. He said, Michael Bay is not only rifling like Scorsese, but he does it with a Quentin Tarantino flair. And I think that, to me, I think fits exactly what I'm thinking. And he actually gave it that grade. He gave the grade an 88 out of 100 on this film. I don't necessarily grade it that high, because I don't think I don't think Michael Bay puts it necessarily to that level. But for him trying something that's different, that's outside of what he normally does, where he's trying to do something a little bit maybe on the Scorsese level, more on the Tarantino level, he doesn't pull it off as well, but he's at least going for it. And I absolutely love that. So I 1,000% disagree with you. This is not a Michael Bay film by any means.
Except that he directed it. Therefore, it is a Michael Bay film.
Of course. And I get that. But in terms of style, it is way different.
Yeah. And actually, I will side with you on that, JD, in a lot of ways. Because, see, I'm not as familiar with the ones I think you're referencing, Nate, like the Bad Boys films. I've never seen those.
Yeah. Those are pretty straightforward. Most of his films are.
And that's the thing is the ones that I do know, and I will go on record to say, and as a general rule of Michael Bay films I've seen, I do not like. Except The Rock, which is one of my all-time favorite movies ever.
It is a great film.
You know, the thing that I did see is one of my biggest complaints about Michael Bay is the editing technique that he chooses to use. And I know that everyone rips on that and things, but it's always been a distracting aspect. Even in The Rock, as much as I love it, it can be distracting. Armageddon is, to me, one of the worst movies ever made because of how poor the editing technique in that film was. But that's the thing I did not see at all in Pain and Gain. Like, this, I would not have been able to say if this was a Michael Bay film, because that's to me the mark of Michael Bay is quick edit. And when I'm watching this, I'm watching the first thing in my mind is, okay, that first scene is going to go away in 1, 2, and then it's going to be gone. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, that's a nice shot. That's a tracking shot. Oh, I like that.
There's a lot of tracking shots in this film.
I was not expecting that. Like, he actually sets up some really great scenes that I'm just like, he's kind of grown up a little bit in terms of the way he's making movies, not necessarily in humor or writing style or anything like that, but visually I think he grew up a little bit.
I think doing Transformers 3 helped him, because that was in 3D, so he really had to, he couldn't do that quick edit stuff, so I think that really helped
him. I think this was maybe a little better movie than Transformers 3, but just because I think he was provided with a better story. But the film technique has much improved. So I'd love to see kind of where he goes next when it's not a Transformers movie and it's not this. I'd like to see something a la The Rock that he'd do.
Sure.
To kind of see, like, okay, now where's he gone now that he's getting more in a groove, you know, kind of in growing up in the way he directs.
And I've read a lot of reviews and watched some videos and stuff this week where that's been a lot of people have been saying that, like, I hope this is the kind of direction that Michael Bay goes with some of his filmmaking going forward. And that's a little bit of what I was just talking about before. Like, this was shot way differently than what he normally does, like you were just saying. And I don't think he pulls it off to the level of how other directors have done this previously.
No.
But I love it that he's at least trying, yeah. and he's trying to become something that's different than what he's known for, and he's trying to become a better filmmaker overall. And I love that he went for it. And the fact that it doesn't necessarily pull off like other directors, I still think he does a good job considering he's never really shot like this before. So, and then the last thing I guess that I want to say about it is, like you, I love the score for this film. Steve Jablonsky is actually my favorite composer in Hollywood right now. I've loved almost everything that he's done. His themes and scores for the Transformers films are unbelievable. He's done a bunch of other stuff for TV. He also did Gangster Squad earlier this year. This is easily his best score since Transformers, the first one, in my opinion. I absolutely love everything he did with this. The theme is great. It, like you were saying, Matthew, it's very fitting to the film. It just brings that somber, serious tone that you kind of get, especially in the later half of the film. So it was absolutely done really, really well, and I absolutely loved it. So, okay, before we move on, any final thoughts, and what grade would you give Michael Bay's Pain and Gain?
I'd give it pain, not gain. I overall gave it a C or a C+, I think, somewhere.
I think you gave it a C.
Yeah, a C. That sounds right.
I give it a D. Go read the newspaper columns it's based on. They're a whole lot better.
Well, I'll 1,000% disagree, as usual. But I think for Bay, doing something different, I think he does a good job with it. Not my favorite Michael Bay by any means still, but I love that he does something different here, and I give it a B-. So I think he does a pretty good job. So with that, we'll move on. Coming up next is the Inception film Top 3, and I think you might like Matthews in this, so be sure to stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Inception Film Podcast. This is episode 10. And when I was coming up with the top list for this week, I was just thinking about, you know, we were reviewing Michael Bay's film Pain and Gain. Michael Bay is pretty known for his straightforward action movies with a whole bunch of comedy in them. So we're going to give our top three action comedies. So as we get ready to go into this, I guess before we get going, did you guys have any specific criteria you use when coming up with your list?
JD, I liked the way you defined it. It's a movie that has a lot of action, and you laughed while watching it. So that's what I used.
I just picked three.
Nate usually doesn't think a whole lot about what he talks about on the podcast. So, all right, well, let's get into it. Number three on your list, or any honorable mentions, Nate, what'd you have?
Well, it was hard enough for me to pick three, so I don't have any honorable mentions, and these three aren't in any particular order. So the first one I'll talk about is Men in Black. I really liked the combo of a serious Tommy Lee Jones and a cocky, sarcastic Will Smith. I think they work great together. The action is great. They're fighting, you know, alien bugs. Will Smith has some great one-liners, and yeah, I really enjoyed this movie.
That was a pretty good one. What'd you have, Matthew, for your number three?
I have the honorable mention first of Lethal Weapon, and without going too much into it, it's, I think, the quintessential like buddy cop movie, and it's the one that, albeit, yeah, I know films have preceded it, but it's the one that really just kind of defined what that genre looks like, and it's a film I had not actually seen until years, at least 20 years after it had come out. And it still really stands as, just to me, one of the funniest action movies I've ever seen. But it didn't have that extra to push it kind of over the edge. My number three is going to be Hot Fuzz from 2006. And Hot Fuzz is, to me, one of the more ridiculous action movies I've ever seen.
It is a pretty good one.
Yeah, I kind of went into it expecting a straightforward film because I had not seen Shaun of the Dead, and I was not familiar with Edgar Wright's movies. And the first time I was like, this is weird. Like, this is really violent, and I'm laughing, but I don't know why I'm laughing, you know, so much of the time. And then on revisit earlier this year, I realized, oh, this is actually a really genius film. From just the opening scenes, of kind of going over Simon Pegg's career and things, and to, you know, his interaction with Nick Frost. Is everything about the film is just utterly hilarious. And if you've not seen it and you are a movie person, I highly suggest you go out and watch it, because one, you'll laugh, and two, you'll get subjected to a lot of unnecessarily gratuitous action violence.
Yeah, it is pretty good. I really enjoy that movie a lot. In fact, that movie made my honorable mentions list. On my honorable mentions, I also have Lethal Weapon, which is a great movie with great comedy in it. I absolutely love it. Nate's number three, Men in Black, also made my honorable mentions. I love Will Smith in that role. Absolutely hilarious. And I also have Tropic Thunder on there, and Scott Pilgrim. Great movies to make my honorable mentions. My number three, it really kind of came down to two, and I guess you can kind of put it into a combined number three, really. But my number three is kind of the Avengers / Iron Man. It's more based off of Iron Man. I wanted to put the Avengers in there just because overall there's a lot of comedy from a lot of different characters and the way they put it together. But I feel like the first Iron Man and the way Robert Downey Jr. does Tony Stark, I think kind of sets the tone for that whole first phase that Marvel had through all of their movies, really. And so the way that Tony Stark, pretty much acted throughout that whole movie was hilarious to me. There's so many scenes that are memorable to me where it just kind of stands out. And he's pretty much sarcastic throughout the whole thing, even in some of the serious parts of the movie. It's it just brings a lot of fun to that character, and I think it really set the tone for that whole first phase, which I'm assuming we'll see when we go to see Iron Man 3 next week. That'll probably just be a continuation. So that was my number three. Nate, what'd you have for your number two?
My next film is Rush Hour 2. The first Rush Hour is pretty good, but the second one's even better. By far the best one of the three. It stars Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker as two very different cops. Jackie Chan provides the action as usual, and Chris Tucker provides the comedy as usual. It's a very interesting, weird duo combination, but they work really well together. They have really good chemistry. And then, you know, obviously it's funny throughout, but the outtakes at the end are hilarious.
Yeah, that's a really great point. The outtakes are hysterical, especially the one where the guy falls out of the building and Chris Tucker says, "You know, he ain't going to be in Rush Hour 3.
And I bet he wasn't.
I don't think he was.
I've not seen it, but I will... I'll put some money on that.
It was great.
He's not into Rush Hour 3. My number two and my number one both are ones that I don't think I would classically think of as when I think action comedy. Using the qualifications that I did of saying it's an action movie and I knew I laughed a lot during it, I said, I'm going to put The Rock in there. Like I said earlier, it's the one Michael Bay film that I really actually like. And I think it's pretty much the epitome of what an action movie needs to be. Action movies can be tense and, you know, dramatic, but there's something about an action movie that can have a sense of humor about itself that I think actually elevates it to a higher level than a film that takes itself completely seriously.
Yeah.
Because I think that when you've got an action movie that has so much hyperbole in it, like The Rock does, where it's, yeah, a general's taken over, Alcatraz, and you know, this scientist has a breakout, this guy who's been in jail for years. And like, it's a super far-fetched plot, but it comes together so well. The fact that it, the entire way through, it has a sense of humor. I love it. And just like I love like the scene in the hotel when Sean Connery's trying to escape, and then when Nick Cage has to chase him through the streets of San Francisco and things. And
sure.
It's a film that knows it's an action movie and knows what it's doing, and also knows it still doesn't take itself completely seriously.
Sure.
It's about 90% serious.
In fact, there's a lot of scenes really where Nicolas Cage is so sarcastic.
Oh yeah, and
everything.
He has so many great one-liners in the movie.
He does.
And I mean, even in tense situations, he can do it well. Where it's like, not that the film, like the integrity of the film is compromised of like turning it to light when it's supposed to be heavy, or vice versa. But that he just blends in. Like, this character makes sense in this role and things. I mean, Sean Connery is super snarky in it.
Yeah.
A la, you know, the dad in Indiana Jones Part 3. But, yeah, it's one of my absolute favorites, and it's one that I will pop in, you know, all the time just to watch. And it's what I think he tried to kind of... To me, of the ones I've seen, Michael Gay has always tried to kind of recapture what he had in The Rock, but to me, I don't think he's ever gotten it.
Yeah, I love that film quite a lot. My favorite scene in that movie is when Nicolas Cage is trying to explain to Sean Connery's character what that gel stuff was, and he was so serious but yet so sarcastic and trying to be funny with some of those lines. I thought he pulled it off really well. It was a really good choice. My number two is a movie that I think when it was written, I don't think it was meant to have as much humor in it as it did. And I don't think it was, a lot of it I think was intentional, but I think a good portion of it wasn't. But I think because of the casting, it came off really great. And that was Die Hard with a Vengeance, which Samuel L. Jackson's character, I think, just kind of comes in and brings a lot of humor to this film. And that's just because him as an actor, he's perfect for this kind of list and this kind of genre, where he can fit a great action role for someone in a movie like this. But he also has just that comedic tone that he carries throughout all of his films. So he's really funny to me, and I thought he had great chemistry with Bruce Willis in this film, and just really pulled it off really well. So Die Hard with a Vengeance is my number two.
My last film is True Lies. I think this is one of James Cameron's best films he's done. There's lots of solid, over-the-top action, like the bridge sequence, which J.J. Abrams rips off in Mission Impossible 3. And then Tom Arnold. He's fantastic. He's hilarious.
Yeah, the True Lies is one definitely one of my tops in terms of that. And I remember, I think I took it really seriously as a kid when I watched it. And when I rewatched it as an adult, I was really surprised. I'm like, oh, this is really funny. Like the scene where he's got Jamie Lee Curtis and he's messing with her, you know, and doesn't know that it's actually her husband in the room and things. And just to Tom Arnold, like, he is one of the highlights of that film. And or when he blows up the embassy at the beginning. Yeah. So just so many awesome things about it. So great choice, Nate. My number one, however, is Die Hard. And I know most of you might look at it like, it's not a comedy. I'm like, well, the thing is, using the same qualifications that I used earlier, I laugh my butt off every time I watch Die Hard. Like, there's so many awesome scenes. I mean, where the classic line that I'm not going to quote here, but y'all know what I'm talking about, has become in the lexicon of, you know... pretty much American society right now of yippee-ki-yay. That was definitely written as a comedic line to have it. Cause I mean, that's not a straightforward, you know, I'm just delivering this, like, it's Bruce Willis getting to flex his comedic muscles. You know, I love, one of my favorite lines is when he's climbing through the vents and being super sarcastic. Yeah, come, you know, have a few drinks, spend some time, have fun. And he's he's just, you know, and he's, what he's doing is, you know, he's trying to break in to kill all the guys who've taken over the place and stuff. And Bruce Willis is just amazing sense of just sarcasm, just plays so well in that film. He plays really well off of so many of the other characters that are not funny. But then you've got, like, Argyle, who is hilarious the entire film through as the limo driver. You know, or... but there's just a lot that's great. Oh, or Holly Gennaro later in the film, decking the news reporter and things like that. Like, just awesome things that every time I watch that, I'm going to laugh at, even though it is the best action movie ever made. And I don't really care anyone who wants to bring up an argument. Die Hard set the bar, and no one has ever surpassed it.
I think we might have a Die Hard series in our future sometime. So
except not number five, please no, not again.
Except that one. Yeah, we might have to throw that one out. That was pretty bad. My number one, with you know, this series has been kind of, or this top list, excuse me, was kind of based off of Michael Bay and his silliness, and I couldn't help but put this number one. This is pretty much easily my number one, and that is his 2003. Bad Boys 2. And the way that Martin Lawrence and Will Smith are in this movie, and really in the whole series, because the first one was pretty much the same thing. Their chemistry is incredible. I absolutely love the way they play off each other. You can tell that they've been around each other a lot because they're able to be friends and be partners as cops, and yet they're so sarcastic with each other. They're really more like brothers in the way that brothers kind of give each other a hard time and joke around with each other. That's pretty much how they are. And there's so much about this film that is hilarious. I can almost quote the whole thing, and I love every second of it. And it still holds up so well. I can easily throw this in right now. I mean, almost 10 years later now, and it still holds up. I love every single line of this and the way that it's done. This is Michael Bay at his... This fits every Michael Bay stereotype easily. It's very straightforward and is kind of dumb in lots of places. But I loved it. I loved it, and I had a lot of fun with it. It was absolutely hysterical to me. So love that film. So we are going to move on, and we're going to continue our Baz Luhrmann series, where we're going to go over his 2001 movie, Moulin Rouge. Will Nate make it 3 for 3 with terrible grades? Find out. Stay tuned. Listening to the In Session Film Podcast. This is episode 10, and we're going to continue on with our Baz Luhrmann series and go over his 2001 film, Moulin Rouge, which stars Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor. This is, I don't know, I feel like this movie is a little bit different than the previous two, Romeo and Juliet and Strictly Ballroom. It's obviously a full-on musical. What did you guys think of Moulin Rouge?
It was fabulous, and I mean that in the best way possible. I loved Moulin Rouge. I saw this film probably about 5 years ago for the first time, and I didn't understand it. I had no concept of who Baz Luhrmann was or what he tried to do with film, because that was the first one I had ever seen of his, and actually I've realized was the first one I saw before I ever started the series of his movies. And I didn't get it. But then again, one of the things that I lacked at that time was the musical knowledge of so many things that he makes reference to throughout the film, which is the thing that makes and kind of seals the deal for that movie, because it's got a super contrived plot that is, and Luhrmann knows this going into it, it's the quintessential love story of, you know, boy A wants girl, but boy B is already going to, you know, was trying to get the girl. How does boy A get it? But boy B foils him. And just, I mean, it's just the simple, you know, romantic story. And Luhrmann knows that. And he said, how do I take this film that's just about love and make it, how do I make people love it? How do I make it kind of this hyperbolic representation of love? And one of the best ways he does it is by pulling in all these songs about love. And that's the thing, is I had no clue about half of the music was, or even not even half, probably almost all of it, that's used in the film. Because, I mean, you've got references to the Beatles, to Nirvana, to Madonna, to so many, just anything from basically, you know, from 60 years forward in the realm of pop music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to up till, you know, 2001, and it all transfers so well to the world of 1899 France, because you're in this super bizarre place that is the Moulin Rouge, with these really weirdo bizarre characters who are actually really funny, not in where like Romeo and Juliet they try to be, but it just doesn't work. In this, they actually are hilarious, like the narcoleptic Argentinian. Like, that's one of the first flashes of comedy in the film. And John Leguizamo as the midget is just, I mean, he plays it so well. I didn't even realize it was John Leguizamo almost all the way throughout the film. Or Richard Roxburgh, who can play comedic and hateful really well as the Duke. You know, that's it. It just all just, it is this lavish production that feels like a stage musical rather than I'm watching a movie, and feels it is a burlesque show. It is all of this. And just, it's just beautiful colors. The costuming is ridiculous. And I know I'm running into myself all over, but the thing is that I loved just the whole presentation of the film. And Luhrmann knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he finally had, I think, the right funding. He finally had the story down, and he had the ability to do it, and he said, let's do it. And I honestly would consider Moulin Rouge a masterpiece, not just in the realm of like movie musicals, but just actually in movies in general.
Well, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I hated Strictly Ballroom and I hated Romeo and Juliet. I didn't quite hate Moulin Rouge, but But I also didn't like it.
Of course.
I thought it was just okay. I mean, I really enjoyed the visuals, especially the opening and the closing with the curtain and the conductor. I thought that was really cool. Like you were talking about the well-known songs in it. I had no clue they use music by, you know, Nirvana, Fatboy Slim, Madonna, and whatnot. So I really liked that. Elton John, too, which that caps what to me is my favorite scene where Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman meet for the first time, and they kind of have a miscommunication of sorts, which is pretty funny. And then he kind of quotes a lyric from Elton John's song. Is it Your
Song?
Your Song, yeah. And then he sings it. I thought that was really well done. That was my favorite scene. Then I thought after kind of the middle portion, I thought it dragged a lot. I was kind of dozing in and out. But the end was really well done, and I really enjoyed the closing credits, which I don't know what that says, but I liked them.
There should be an asterisk there that Nate was on NyQuil at this time, and that's yes. Why he dozed, not because it's a bad movie.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. I agree with a lot of the things you guys have said already. The opening sequence, like you were saying, Nate, is amazing. I love the conductor and his movements and the way the curtain moves and how the camera was shot right there. I absolutely love that. All you guys have already touched on the music and how awesome that was. And going into it, I had, like you guys, had no idea that they used these songs in this film. The first time I had seen it was a couple of years ago, but I didn't remember much about it until I rewatched it this week. I loved a lot of the music and the way they played that, especially within the first 20 minutes of the film. I absolutely loved that. My first immediate reaction, though, was, and I couldn't leave this out, I just had to say it, so this is going to be the first time that we're going to have to use the bleep button, and I cannot help myself, but this movie is so goddamn weird, and I mean that in the best way possible. Like, I was watching it, and that was my immediate thought in terms of the way the movement was, and the costumes was crazy, and the way they set the tone for Moulin Rouge was so Baz Luhrmann-esque, but I loved it. I loved it. And I loved the way that they set it up. And so, like you were saying, Matthew, it really put me into where they were in terms of the setting. And I felt like I was at the Moulin Rouge, and I thought they did a really great job with that. I love the central themes in this movie. As far as, you know, love being the carrying force for Ewan McGregor's character, as far as pushing him through, you know, fighting for this girl and, you know, fighting for love. And that's the thing that really compels him forward. And while he had his struggles and there was a lot of things that went back and forth, in the end, that's what the theme was all about. And that's, you know, what, you know, carried you all the way to the very end. And the closing sequences was very well done, like Nate said. And I love the colors in this film. Now, there was lots of bright colors at lots of times, and some at some moments it was more, I don't know what a good word for it is. It was just kind of a little dull, but intentionally, and it still kind of came through in the right moment. So a lot of it was kind of faded, and kind of there were some darker colors in some points. I love the way that he kind of put it together. It was done perfectly. Baz Luhrmann absolutely did a great job with using all of the sets and the costumes that he did, and he got great performances that I absolutely loved. And the songs were a lot of fun, and in the end, it was very emotional, and it was sad, and then it does a 180 almost like 5 minutes later. So It was really great.
One thing I just wanted to comment on from what you were saying was you comment about how weird it is, and I don't disagree. Like, it is a weird movie. I think anything Luhrmann puts his hands to is just going to have that seal of weird on it, because that's just what he does. And I think that's part of where I like his approach. But I think this is giving me some vocabulary now to talk more about Luhrmann films now that I'm seeing more of them.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the difference between, or among, I should say, Strictly Ballroom, Romeo and Juliet, and Moulin Rouge, where you've got Strictly Ballroom, where the weirdness sometimes feels like it's contained in the film, but sometimes feels like this is just being added, and like, where's this coming from? Which has the viewer kind of questioning, or I'm wondering if that's where a lot of Nate's, you know, kind of distaste for the film came from. And then you've got Romeo and Juliet, which for me, the weirdness does not make sense in that film, in that plot, in that, even in the style of film, it doesn't make sense, because to me, that was the weird one, because it just felt like such an oddball film, because of just like the drag, the modern scenery, just the way that some of the lines are delivered, the sped up scenes, all that kind of stuff that just makes it weird. And then,
but that's
what
drew me to that movie specifically.
Yeah.
But
then the thing is, with Moulin Rouge, to me, the weirdness worked, because you have a world where you are already willing to accept that this is just what happens, this kind of weirdness and stuff, where because it's already a fantasy, you know, compared to me, Strictly Ballroom and Romeo and Juliet feel like they're supposed to be a little more realistic, like actually steeped in reality kind of films. And this one, you already know it's a fantasy. Like from the opening, like the fact that the way it opens the curtain and things, and it's a long time ago.
You're being drawn into a different world.
Exactly.
You know that. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why I'm saying the weirdness works. So, albeit it's weird, do you think that actually works in its favor here?
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. I guess the only thing with that I would disagree with is I feel like the intentionality of what he was going in with Romeo and Juliet was to make it modernized, and what you say makes it weird is what draws me in. And I feel like with Strictly Ballroom, while it was weird, it was kind of set into a more realistic tone, where this is, like you were saying, it is so intentionally weird, but it works really well, like you said. And I think I fell in love with it right away. But it was my first immediate response. It was like, holy crap. But it's Baz Luhrmann, and he does that intentionally, but he does it so well.
Yeah, he does.
And I absolutely fell in love with the setting. So even though it was fictionalized, I absolutely loved being drawn into that kind of an environment. I thought it was done really, really well.
Yeah, I found myself I downloaded the soundtrack like halfway through listening to the film, and soundtrack is one of the, albeit the soundtrack does not have a lot of the songs straight from the film. They're actually like remixed versions of them. I still highly recommend it because it's a great representation of what the film's like. But this is a film that is both an aural and visual experience.
Well,
so
you know,
really
they have the original songs from the movie on Spotify.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, I'll show
definitely.
You afterwards.
Cool. Let's
you
it.
Can listen to them. Nate, do you have any final thoughts on Moulin Rouge?
Just that I thought it was okay.
One question. What do you think of the exclamation point in the title? Is it necessary?
Really hammers the
Moulin Rouge.
Well, that I think is fitting to the movie, because there was a lot of yelling and lots of passion behind
a
lot
actually,
of the
lines. That was one of the things I did love. I realized as I was typing up some of the review for this that it does have the exclamation point in the title. That's actually part of it, and it's a great representation of the film. This is a film that punches. This is a film that has real character to it.
Sure.
And so I love that even that just piece of punctuation kind of really accentuates what Luhrmann's about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. I never really thought about it much, but that makes a lot of sense. The other thing, I guess, I didn't really mention this when I was talking about before. One thing that I noticed is the camera, what Baz Luhrmann was doing with this, is always in motion. It's just always moving around. Even like when Nicole Kidman's character, she's just going to pick up like a pen or a piece of paper, the camera's just kind of moving around her, and then it's kind of zooming toward what she's doing. So I loved what he did with that. It wasn't shaky cam. It was smooth. It was tracking. And I thought he was very elegant. And with a movie where there's lots of dancing and movements, I thought he did it perfectly.
Yeah, and he has no static shots, and I think that's actually quite a mark of what he's about, is his world, things are always happening. Things are always moving. There's no there's no time to not move and things like that. Yeah. And Moulin Rouge, that's what it's about. It's about seeing things happen and stuff. So great observation on that.
Thank you, sir. Well, final grades. What did you guys give a final grade?
I give it an A.
I gave Strictly Ballroom an F. I gave Romeo and Juliet a D. So I'm going to give Moulin Rouge a C. So I think the Great Gatsby might be in good shape.
So Australia's going to get a B, and then Great Gatsby's going to get an A.
Hey, going into the series, I did think that was going to be Nate's favorite was Australia. Until maybe Gatsby comes out. So
that'll
we'll
be
see.
Fun. We'll see.
So we'll see about that. I gave it an A minus as well. So I loved it. I thought it was done very well. So, all right. Well, we're going to move on to some movies we've seen this week and a couple of news items. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. And yes, I did watch a lot of movies this week. You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast. This is episode 10, and we're going to be talking about a couple of news items before we get into movies that we've seen this week. A couple of trailers that I wanted to talk about first. There was a new movie for the Thor sequel that is going to be coming out, Thor the Dark World. And what did you guys think of the trailer? Did you guys like it and make you excited for the sequel?
To be honest, no. And Thor was one of my favorite movies, actually, from, 2010 came out? And,
I believe so.
It was one of my favorite movies, and I'm kind of looking at the Thor of the Dark World of, like, I mean, I'll see it. I know I will. That's just what I do, but it wasn't capturing me until the very last scene. And spoiler alert for the two-minute trailer, Loki shows up at the end. That was the one part where I kind of got excited. I think the problem with the trailer is I don't know exactly what's going on. I don't know kind of what's at stake and things. And it also feels like it's got kind of the unfortunate pitfall of a lot of sequels of it looks like it's going to be more about plot and action than it is about character development, which is really hard to do in superhero movies, because that's something that's so great about the first film is it has to be about character development. And you'll see always the superhero movies that are done well focus on that in that first one. And then the second one, if it kind of shoves character development off to the side, it just kind of like, yeah, that was a visually fun movie and it was kind of good, but it's not at the same caliber as the previous film compared to, like, I think Iron Man 2 did a great job of still doing character development as opposed to that. That's my fear for Thor 2.
I thought the trailer was okay. I mean, I'm not super excited about it. It appears very dark, as the title suggests. It looks like there's going to be lots of action. And it also appears that something's going to happen to Natalie Portman's character. And I think she's going to die off. She didn't even want to be in this film. So I think this is it for her.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think they do make that obvious. I mean, I liked it. I didn't hate it. I like you, Matthew, I liked the first one quite a bit, and I liked Chris Hemsworth Thor in the Avengers too. I thought they did a great job of carrying that storyline over. So overall, I'm pretty excited for it. It's got a new director in Alan Taylor, who hasn't done a lot of film, but he's done lots of TV. He's known for the Game of Thrones, especially as of late. So I'm pretty excited for that. And one of my favorite parts about the first Thor movie was the score, which was done by Patrick Doyle. And he is not doing this one. Carter Burwell is doing this one, but he's done quite a few things that I've liked in the past also. So I'm excited for that. Overall, I'm probably not as excited for Iron Man 3, but I do look forward to it. And I mostly look forward to seeing how they continue it with just the whole story arc of the whole phase 2 and how they carry that over. That's mostly what I'm excited for this film. There was also a new trailer for The Bling Ring, which is set to come out in June of this year, which this is Sofia Coppola's new movie. In this trailer, they revealed a lot more than the teaser. What did you guys think about the Bling Ring trailer?
I loved it. Sofia Coppola and I are copacetic, you could say. And I just love her sense of humor in all of her movies. Some of my favorite parts in it are towards the end, one of the characters that's starting to get busted for breaking into the houses as they're doing. saying, hey, we talked to all the victims. And she goes, so did you talk to Lindsay Lohan? What did she say? And I love Sofia Coppola with this eye of saying, I know I'm making fun of this, but do you get that this gal actually believed this? And because this is a true story, like, I love just the eye that Sofia Coppola had to that, and to these characters that look like these are characters that I'm going to watch and start judging and then actually have sympathy for, which is often what you can do in a film. And so I am super excited for it. The visual style also looks really awesome, as well as I know the soundtrack's going to be killer. So I'm really excited.
I'm on the completely opposite spectrum of you. I'm not excited to see this at all. The trailer did nothing for me. It doesn't look interesting at all. And if Sofia Coppola and Emma Watson weren't attached, I wouldn't go see it.
Do you like Sofia Coppola's other movies?
I do. But the trailer did nothing for me. Other than, I mean, like I said, if she didn't make it, if Emma Watson wasn't in it, I wouldn't go see it.
Interesting. I'm like you, Matthew. I think it looks pretty good. I'll be interested to see the parallels. In some ways, obviously not to the degree of what we just saw in Pain and Gain, but it being about a ridiculous story and seeing which direction they take in terms of, you know, are they going to be making fun of these main characters or how they go about it. So overall, though, I liked it. It looks like a lot of fun. So I will disagree with Nate on that part of it. I think Emma Watson's going to bring a lot to this film, though. And obviously, Sofia Coppola is great. I love a lot of the things that she's done. So I'm pretty excited for it overall. The last quick thing that we'll talk about, we don't have to go into this a ton of detail, but The Expendables 3 has a new director, and it's not a well-known name, and it is just Patrick Hughes. He only has one other feature film that he's done, which was Red Hill in 2010. What did you guys think about Stallone going after a relatively new director?
I mean, it could give a really fresh face to the Expendables films, but I don't know if that's a safe, you know, place for the Expendables films to go, though, because I really did enjoy the first Expendables quite a bit. And did Stallone actually direct the first one?
Or yes, I believe so. Yeah, but that's right. So.
And with the second one, directed by Simon West, who was a veteran action movie director who did Con Air and other such films, I actually thought that was, like, as much as I did love the first Expendables, Expendables 2 was even better action, even funnier movie. So, I mean, yeah, if Stallone's trying to put a new face on it, but the thing is, the Expendables doesn't need a new face. It needs an old face. That's why they work in the first place, is because you've got these veteran actors, and going to someone like Simon West made it even better. Well, how about, you know, they stick with that. But, I mean, I trust Stallone. There's very few things he does that I'd hate, you know? So maybe it could be good for it, but I think it could be actually a pitfall.
I like that Stallone's given kind of a new, young, up-and-comer a chance. And like you were saying with the old faces, Stallone actually was trying to court Mel Gibson to direct. And John Woo showed interest, too.
Ooh.
So he kind of passed on them to hire this new guy.
Okay.
But I don't think he was very serious about the Mel Gibson thing. Like, he tweeted about it and then immediately went, I was just kidding about that, but, like, what if we did that for real? So, like, yeah,
but,
I don't know.
That would be awesome. He's one of the most competent action movie directors that there is.
I agree with Nate on this one. I love the fact that they're giving a fresh face to this a little bit, mostly because I feel like this is going to be a pretty safe film for him. I don't think they necessarily have to have the greatest of directors for this, because it's going to be the old action actors that carry this film. I mean, because Jackie Chan has been rumored to be in this. I don't think they finalized that. Wesley Snipes has also been rumored to be in this. And then you have, you know, Jackie Chan and all the other guys from the previous ones, you know, if they are to return. And I think those actors are going to be carrying the film. I don't think they necessarily have to have the greatest of directors. So I think this will be a great opportunity to bring in someone who's fresh, who's new, give him an opportunity, and it'll be a pretty safe bet. And because of the second one and the first one doing as well as they did, it'll get people into the theaters to see it, most likely. So unless he royally screws us up, and with those kind of guys there and having Stallone kind of backing him, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, and honestly, I think the only way you can royally screw up the Expendables movie is not recasting Chuck Norris.
Yeah, that's
because that's
point.
What amazingly improved the.
Well, he already said he's not coming back. So.
Well, then this movie sucks.
We don't want to do it. We're not going to see it. Never mind.
So.
Yeah, but they say that all the time, and then they end up coming back. Yeah. So
hopefully.
Hopefully. So, all right. Well, let's move on and talk about some movies we've seen this week. What did you guys get? You guys get a chance to see anything?
I saw just the two we've already spoken of, so I'll turn it over to someone else.
The only other film I saw this week was Terminator Salvation, and I blame that on the sickness.
It made you choose that poorly?
That's what I'm going with. Yeah, I don't even know why the film was made. It's okay. Christian Bale phones it in big time. Really all the actors do. Special effects are good, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk a little bit about the film. It's been a long time. I mean, probably since it came out. What was that, 2007 or so that came out? And I don't remember hating it, but I just remembered so much of it. It was like, you're right, Nate. I think it felt just unnecessary. Like, it's Warner Brothers wanted to make a buck, or Fox, I forget which. Just wanted to make a buck, you know, kind of off of the Terminator franchise. And I do love the idea of it. I think it was really great. I liked the casting of Anton Yelchin a lot in it as the young...
I actually never saw it, so...
Oh, really?
Basing it off you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad movie, per se. It's just kind of... This is here, and it's obvious it's only meant to make money. There's a really laughable sequence towards the end where a CG... And I'm sorry, spoiler alert. But it's been out for, you know, 5 years. So, but a CGI'd Arnold Schwarzenegger shows up.
I did hear about that, though.
Yeah, it kind of matches where I, just as a viewer, was with the film. I actually saw it twice in theaters, once with a friend of mine, once with my mom. And so I kind of, like, got a good taste for it. And I'm just like, yeah, it's kind of, that's representative of the film. Like, this film does feel a little bit jokey, a little bit just, we're trying to pay homage without having the real thing, because Schwarzenegger is not actually in the film. He was still the governor of California at that time, and so not doing any films. And so, I mean, it's not him, and it feels like a replica rather than an original piece. So it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, Nate, I do blame the sickness, too. I'll accept that argument.
So other than the sickness, what else made you pick this film? I mean, you just wanted to throw in something to fall asleep to, or what?
I mean, I saw it was playing on TV, so I just recorded it. For the hell of it, to watch.
Okay. You were delusional.
That works too, I guess.
You couldn't have found Terminator 2 or something like that, like in a freaking epic movie.
Do you know there's this channel called AMC?
Yeah.
And they play a lot of great movies
there's
there.
There's like TCM. There's even... You could even freaking watch PBS and at least watch some Downton Abbey.
FX has some good...
Come on.
...movies on TV every now and then, too.
You have freaking Netflix. Yes, we're judging
Netflix
you right
even?
Now.
Yeah.
I love
there's so much more you could have watched. Yeah.
We love you.
But we love you, though.
Don't go.
Okay. Well, I got to see a couple of different films outside of the main ones we got to go see. The first one I got to see was Ji-Woon Kim's The Last Stand, which stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, ironically.
No longer the governor of California.
No longer the governor. This also has Forrest Whitaker and, for some reason, Johnny Knoxville. And this movie was okay. I mean, it wasn't the greatest thing I've ever seen by any means. I mean, man, making fun of Michael Bay for being straightforward action. This is as straight as it gets, and it's all action. So, there's nothing in this that makes you feel like there's going to be twists and turns or anything like that. So, it was okay. I thought for Arnold, I believe this was his first major one outside of The Expendables.
Yeah,
but
this was
like
his
a main
first starring role post-political office.
So, and I thought he does a good job. I mean, some of it is a little ridiculous, him being that old and doing some of the stunts he's doing.
Yeah,
but
so does, you know, Bruce Willis in later Die Hard films and things.
That's a good point. And I don't know. There's a trend.
I mean, so does
there's
Clint
a trend
Eastwood.
About there's a trend about these actors getting that old and doing these action films
and
them
still
not being
showing
good.
That they can still kick A, you know.
But those films aren't that great, though.
The Clint Eastwood ones are.
Which one? Grant. Well, yeah, but he's not doing action in that.
Oh,
though.
Okay. So not doing actual stunts. Okay,
yeah,
that's
what I'm saying.
About.
That film was great, but not because he was doing action.
Okay,
in it.
I understand that. So,
yeah, but, I mean, I'm just like Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger are going out there and trying to be like they're 30 years younger. So
yeah,
so watch that one. I also watched Tom Cruise's Jack Reacher, which came out at the end of last year, and this movie was it was actually better than I anticipated because it didn't really get a ton of great reviews, and a lot of people were pretty much dissing it, which was everything that I was reading. So I didn't go into it with a bunch of expectations, but I actually liked it. I thought Tom Cruise played the role really well. I thought the story was pretty good. I thought it was a little bit different for Tom Cruise. In some ways, he wasn't necessarily playing an action star. He was kind of an investigator cop, that, you know, which turns into a little bit of action toward the end, but it's mostly him just kind of playing this witty, investigator cop, that used to work for the military. And, the story is, it's an interesting one, I think. So, not one of Tom Cruise's better movies by any means, but, I thought it was still pretty good. So I enjoyed it. I also watched Matt Damon's Promised Land, which was directed by Gus Van Sant. And this movie is also pretty different I guess it depends on how you know Matt Damon, but, this is an interesting story. It's basically about, Matt Damon's character he's working as a salesman for this natural gas company, and he goes to the small town basically trying to buy these plots of land so that way his company can drill and get up a bunch of natural gas. And the small town is pretty much rebelling and they don't want to do it. And then there's a part where the movie kind of shifts and it becomes more about the town and kind of taking on a vote as far as, wanting to push Matt Damon out. And it becomes this kind of, I'm not exactly sure how to describe it. It just kind of becomes this, back and forth between the town and Matt Damon and them pushing for them to kind of drill. And it kind of sounds kind of boring on the surface, but it's actually done pretty well for the most part. So it's not one you really want to go and sit down to if you're really looking to have a fun time. But if you're looking for something kind of relaxy and just kind of want to sit back and chill, it's a good one for that.
And I'd just like to take a little side note and talk about Gus Van Sant. He's a director who typically takes about two different types of movies, either the ones that are his own personal projects, or I think a lot of times the ones that are his friends' projects. And this was one of his friends' projects. I don't know if you knew this, JD, or not, but it was written by John Krasinski and Matt Damon, actually.
I did see that.
And yeah. Matt Damon had penned Good Will Hunting as well with Ben Affleck back in, 96, 97. The films always kind of have two different feels to it, and this feels like this is that really kind of straightforward. It's a compelling story, but that's about it. And that's actually one of the reasons I kind of shied away from it, even though I do like Gus Van Sant films as a general rule. I tend to prefer the films that Gus Van Sant himself wrote, which are they tend to be the weirder movies that he makes, like Paranoid Park, Elephant, My Own Private Idaho. Even Malinoche, his first film back in 1986. And so I think there's where Gus Van Sant says these are the I Have to Pay the Bills movies, you know, and taking him on and knowing they'll hopefully make some money and just doing, like, I think, favors, you know, for his friends and making still respectable films nonetheless. But to me, not doing the kind of audacious experimental things that I actually like seeing him do more.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a pretty interesting story. And I think especially if you're into this type of stuff, I think it's easy for you to get drawn into what they're trying to do. And
yeah. It sounds a lot like kind of a Nikon Era Brockovich kind of film, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that, you know, and it looks like a great movie.
So I really enjoyed it, and I think it does a pretty good job of weighing both sides of the story. So I think they're not necessarily wanting to offend environmentalists, and they're also not wanting to necessarily offend people that are pro natural gas either. So
you're saying Gus Van Sant is like Fox News, he's fair and balanced.
Well, don't get me started on that. I think they do a good job, though, of telling both sides of the story. So it definitely leaves you to make your own opinion.
Nice.
So, and in the end, I think they end up, they do take one side, but I think it, given the characters that they have in the film, it's done the best way. So I thought it was done really, really well. And then the other movie that I saw was WALL-E, which was the animated film in 2008 that turned out pretty well. So, and I was interested to rewatch it because I only saw it the one time. And after talking about Oblivion last week, I kind of wanted to watch it to revisit some of the comparisons. But
yeah, WALL-E was definitely one of my favorite films from 2008. I have just a special place for Pixar films in my heart. But there's something about WALL-E that it's such a ridiculously smart film for a so-called kids movie. I was really blown away by just the amount of actual straight up criticism that it had for just the way that we as Americans especially live. And I loved how bold and audacious the film was, how it didn't
get trapped up in the
aspects of it that are a little kiddish. It didn't get trapped up in that. Like, it actually let, this really almost adult story, take hold. And the other thing that is so admirable about the film is the entire almost first half of the film has no dialogue.
Yeah.
It plays off as a silent film.
Noises and
yeah.
stuff.
And, but the thing is, well, so did, Charlie Chaplin films from the 20s and the 30s. They just had sound, and yet they were remarkably hilarious and heartfelt, and WALL-E does that perfectly. Plus, while creating this beautifully just stunning visual world where it all takes place, and creating emotional depth of characters, too, of not just WALL-E and Eve later, but actually even like the little cockroach. Like,
yeah,
I would never have imagined really liking a cockroach as a character, but it's really sweet. It's really funny, and
they do a really great job.
And so just the film as a whole is one of the more remarkable animated films from the past, 20 some years.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I mean, I think how you just described it is perfect. I mean, from the emotional depth that you get to it just being so heartwarming, it just really draws you in really great. And for an animated movie, I think it's so easy to get drawn into the world they created. So it was done really, really well. And then the last film I watched, I won't go into it a whole lot, but was The Firm. And after you talking about it last week, I had to give that a rewatch, which was a lot of fun. I'm glad I did it. So that should be it. Before we get out of here, fellas, any final thoughts on anything?
Still really looking forward to Iron Man 3 next week, and I'd love to see this Baz Luhrmann series, concluded with Great Gatsby in 2 weeks. So getting really excited for both of those.
Super excited about Iron Man 3.
What are your thoughts on Great Gatsby?
We'll see.
Nice. We will see it. It's true.
We will see it. I just like you, Matthew, I'm excited to see how that series, kind of finishes out. And I'm glad that we did it. I've loved getting to know Baz Luhrmann a lot better as a director. And
yeah, just a guy I didn't know anything about, and then actually realizing there's a lot to learn about this guy through he's actually only made 5 films, and already through 3, I'm getting a great sense of just personality of what he does and things. So
yeah,
to see what he can bring into this really revered classic story, I'm looking forward to it.
Sure. Yeah, I 100% agree with you there. I'm pretty excited to see how this finishes out, and looking forward to Australia next week. And we're also going to be going over Iron Man 3, like you said. And we're also going to be going to see Mud also, which at the end of this podcast, we're actually going to be playing Nate and I's extra film segment where we got to review Trance, which was an okay film. So you can definitely take a listen to that. And so we'll be seeing Mud for our extra film segment, and then we'll be reviewing Iron Man 3 next week on the podcast. So as always, be sure to check us out on Facebook. We're always actively on Facebook. So be sure to go and comment and let us know what you think about our stories. Give us some feedback, and you can find us at Facebook.com/InSessionFilm. Also, find us on Twitter @InSessionFilm, actively tweeting all the time. And we've actually had some pretty good feedback on Twitter over the last several weeks, so we're pretty grateful for that. And thanks for everyone who's followed us on Twitter. We're also on Google+ and YouTube. We actually do video reviews for all of our written reviews that we have on the website also. So be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can also subscribe to us on SoundCloud. All of our stuff goes up there, which you can listen to on our Listen Live page on our website. So be sure to go and check that out. And I think that'll do it.
This is Matthew Mason.
Nate Parsons.
This is JD Duran. Everyone have a wonderful week. Go see Iron Man 3. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Hey guys, this is JD Duran, and alongside me is Nate Parsons. In the last few weeks, we've gotten to see quite a few movies that we don't really get a whole lot of time to talk about on the podcast, and we don't really like the term mini podcast. So these new segments that we're going to be doing, we're just going to call them Extra Film, which you can find under the podcast section on our website. And for this week's Extra Film, we are going to be talking about the movie Trance, which is Danny Boyle's newest film, which stars James McAvoy, Rosario Dawson, and Vincent Cassell. This movie has got a lot of different layers and elements to it. Nate, what did you think about Danny Boyle's new film, Trance?
I think this movie is a prime example of why you need to watch a movie all the way until the end, because the first two-thirds of it, I was not on board. But the final third, when they give the big reveal, to me, that was the best part of the movie. And, I mean, that's really the only reason why I'm going to give this a passing grade.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I think what I love about this film is I love the visuals in this film. I mean, there's a lot of bright colors, and I think Danny Boyle does a good job of putting you in the environment of a trance. I feel like with the words and the dialogue that comes out of Rosario Dawson's character and the way that she makes you feel like you're sitting on the chair, so to speak, what I feel like I'm being drawn into his environment and into the experience, which I loved. And so that part I really loved about this film. I thought Danny Boyle did a great job of that. But like you were saying, the story could really be summed up in the last 20 minutes or so of this movie. The first two-thirds of this movie is really kind of back and forth. I didn't know if I was in a trance or if I was in reality. I didn't know what was going on. And while that could be a good thing for the most part, the way that they did this movie at the end in the last 20 minutes, it really summed it up, and it didn't really bring it full circle like how I liked it in Inception, which is a good comparative movie to what this movie would say. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I did like the way they started this movie with no setup. They just got right to it. But then after that, it kind of just loses its luster, like you were saying, in that middle section. There's some nice flashback scenes throughout, but overall, I mean, you only need to watch that last 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, that's a really great point. What did you think of the performances, especially from James McAvoy and Rosario Dawson specifically?
I thought they were just okay. I mean, we really don't get any insight into their characters, which makes the final couple of scenes, you know, there's no emotional impact. We don't really care what's going on with them. The only one who comes close to that is Vincent Cassell's character. I think he does the best job out of all three. And he actually did a really good job in Black Swan, and he was the only aspect of that film I liked, and he's one of the few aspects of this film I like too.
That's an interesting, and I said you put that in an interesting way to me, because I actually liked Rosario Dawson's character specifically. I don't know if I care too much for James McAvoy's character like you, but I loved Dawson's character. I think she does a really great job of making you feel like you know what's going on from her side of things. Like, she's just kind of caught up in this world and trying to help these guys, and where the story and the plot kind of takes a little bit of a turn toward the end, which you can kind of see coming, I guess, if you look at it, if you're really looking for it. But her character really drew me in. I thought Vincent Cassell does a great job too, but as the main antagonist of the movie, I don't know if I was paying too much attention to that, but you put that in a pretty interesting way. Another aspect of this film, and I don't know if you got it, if you really caught this or not, Nate, but was the score by Rick Smith, who actually hasn't scored a whole lot. He's only done a few other things, but especially in the last 30 minutes of this film, the score really amps up and is a huge, huge part of the ending, which you were talking about, which really made this film amazing toward the end.
Yeah, the score is very frenetic, but it's also very trance-like, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's a really great point.
And it has kind of like a underground dance party feel to it. It's just kind of in your face, frenetic, like I was saying. And yeah, I mean, it's really good.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. If you're going to go see this movie, I would definitely recommend it to a certain level. Again, don't go in with high expectations, I don't think necessarily, but it's not a terrible film by any means, and it's something that where the visuals, I think, really can and the experience of what he's trying to do in terms of the culture of the environment, I think, is really well put together. Nate, do you have any final thoughts and a grade on Danny Boyle's latest film?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going in expecting like Slumdog Millionaire or 127 Hours, you're not going to get that. Trance has a very B-movie feel to it, which I think that's the whole point of it. So, I mean, if you're looking for that, then this might be something you need to see. But overall grade, I'd give it a B-.
Yeah, I'm pretty much right in the same area as you. This definitely doesn't live up to Danny Boyle's other films by any means. I'm right in that same area. It's about a B-. Definitely could have been a lot better. I think that mostly goes towards a poor script, in my opinion, and I didn't really care for that. But I loved what he did with it in terms of the visuals, and he gets decent performances. So that is our extra film session on Trance. We actually just went and saw Michael Bay's new movie tonight, Pain and Gain, which we will do this weekend on our main podcast, so be sure to check that out. So for Nate Parsons, I'm JD Duran. Everyone have a great weekend, and we'll see you this weekend on our podcast.